Be about 5 minutes close, and I'll try to remember at the end of the hour not to make you late to your next class. I have a very intelligent question given me at the end of the last hour. It relates to the section of the book that I ran over rapidly because it was not what we had in mind for our main emphasis this time. So I won't take long at it, but it's one that I think is well worth looking at. The question is, could you comment on what is a smoking flax and reed or broken reed in Isaiah 42:3? Now that Isaiah 42:3 taken just by itself, let's say the first two-thirds of it, you wouldn't have any idea what it means. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. That could mean any one of 100 different things when you just take that alone. When you read the rest of the verse, he shall bring forth judgment into truth, you see that you are speaking about one who is doing a task, one who is going forward to accomplish something. And when you look at the preceding and following verses, that is quite clear that that's what it is. That someone is undertaking a great task, he is going forward to fulfill this task, and in the course of it, he will not break a bruised reed, and he won't quench a smoking flax. And so you have a picture of one who is headed for a task, a very vital task, and whatever gets in his way, he's apt to just throw out of the way and be done with. And he's not going to do that. And what is it he's not going to break? A broken reed. Well, what would a reed be? A reed would be like a cane. It'd be something that you lean on, or something that you use for some purpose. And here you take a hold of something, and it just doesn't accomplish the work. And you say, oh, throw it away, let's get a new one. But no, he's not going to do that. A bruised reed, he's not going to break. And a smoking flax, this refers to in our day, we just turn the button and the electricity comes on. But in those days, they did not have electricity or even kerosene lamps. And so they had to have a little wick. This really should be a wick. And here is a little wick that gives you light. And maybe the oil is underneath and comes up through the wick and gives you the light. And some wicks don't work very well. And instead of giving light, all it gives is smoke. And you say, throw away that one. Get us a new wick. But the picture here is of those who are trying to serve the Lord, sincerely trying to the best of their ability to understand what the Lord's will is and to accomplish it. And as they try to do it, they just have not certain particular abilities that they need. Or perhaps they have made some bad mistakes and they have fallen back in their they have injured themselves. They failed to do what the Lord wanted, but they have repented. They have come to him, sought his forgiveness. He has granted it through the blood of Christ. They are cleansed from their sin, but they still are a broken reed or a smoking flax. The bird with the broken wing never flies as high again. And under those circumstances, it is very easy to give way to despair. But the true servant of the Lord is one who has the great task of bringing light to all the nations, but one who is interested in every one of them. And on account of our failures and our weaknesses, he's not going to just toss us out of the way. If we sincerely look to him and sincerely try to do his will and bring our faults and our sins before him for his cleansing, he doesn't promise that he will make us great evangelists, or great accomplishers necessarily. He will use us in proportion to our abilities and in proportion to his particular desires for us in his plan. But he won't toss us out of the way and say, oh, that one's no good, let's get one that's better. And so that is, in the light of the context, that is undoubtedly what this particular statement means. It shows the gentle ness of the servant and his confidence. He's not one who is struggling to get results than he has to throw out of his way. When you are in an ordinary circumstance, you are very careful not to break things. And you would feel very badly if you upset your table and broke your china or broke your glasses. But if there was a fire started there, and you had the chance to rush over and to crush out that fire before your house burned down, you wouldn't worry about how much china you broke or how many glasses you broke. Anything that got in your way would be very secondary. It's like when I hear somebody who's been in a bad auto accident, and they have come through it without any much injury. The car perhaps is ruined, but we say, isn't it wonderful you weren't hurt? We don't feel so bad about the car. We feel happy that the person wasn't injured. Well, that's not the way he's going to have to work. He doesn't have to just struggle to accomplish his work. He goes forward with confidence and certainty to accomplish the task to which he has set himself. And so that, I think, I believe that you would find that as to the meaning of this verse, all commentaries would agree. I don't think that it is a questionable thing at all. But it is something that is not apparent when we first look at it. And so I thought it was worth taking a minute to look for that. Yes? Yes. Very good. And Francis Schaeffer's written the book, No Little People. That's just the name of the first of the series of talks. But it deals with that. But in God's sight, there are no little people. That is, we had a student once who was, I would say, he was right at the top of the lowest third of the class in just about every regard, academically and personally and every other one. But he got a letter from his mother, and she said, what does Billy Graham have that you don't have? Why can't you accomplish everything that Billy Graham did? Just get busy and work. Well, that's no way to help a fellow. If he did the best he could with the abilities he had, I'm sure God would use him and bless him. But to make one of us think that we have got to have particular abilities that only a few people perhaps have is not helpful. But on the other hand, every one of us probably can accomplish much more than we do if we will really try to do the very best we can with what we have. Well, this is showing that, after all, the work is Christ. He's the one who does it, and he will use it. But he doesn't want us to become discouraged or think because of our failures he's going to throw us out of the way. If we're sincerely trusting him and resting in him, we can depend upon it for his accomplishment. And there's many a person who has seen, who has worked hard and has had great effects for a time, and then things have come along with which they had no control. And they look back on their life and think it was a waste and a ruin, when actually it wasn't at all in God's sight. He didn't cast aside the broken reed. Well, I gave you an assignment for last time, as you went over those verses, that's a little ahead of where we are now. We will discuss it later. But as you went over those verses, I'm sure you all noticed that I had included a few verses at the beginning and end, I believe, of both of them, both sides, that didn't have any parallel in the other. But that there was a large section, the greater section of what I gave you, had very close parallels in the other section, three or four chapters further on. And I imagine most of you were struck by the fact that a few of the verses toward the end of one of them had close parallels, fairly close, toward the beginning of the other. But that the larger part of the two of them had very close parallels. We will discuss that more later. I have taken the verses from chapter 59 that have the closest parallels, that section. That's not the whole section that had parallels, but it's about four-fifths of it. And I have typed them out starting at the left-hand side of the page. And then I have indented, after each verse or section of verse, I have given the verses from the others that are close parallels, and that makes it a little easier to see just how close the parallels of thought are between these two, although arranged in somewhat different order. I left out the smaller section of parallels. This is one rather unified section. And so I ran off on the machine to copy the list, and occasionally there's a slight comment, but mostly it's just verses. First, the verses from one side in order, on the other side, the parallel verses, and sometimes the same verse occurs more than once on the right hand side. And so, at the end of the hour, you can take a copy of it. If you'd like to refresh your memory on it, or if you still remember it well, let's go on. But it might be helpful if we look forward to the next lesson. Now, by the next lesson, I hope to be discussing the section after the first part of this that I gave you, chapter 59, going on into the latter part of 59 and 60 and 1, 2, and 3. Now, there's four chapters, or three in a fraction chapter, that I'd like you just to look over in the English, or you use the Hebrew if you prefer, but look it over rapidly, just in order to see the main divisions. Just the main divisions and the main subject matter. Don't take any division you find in a Bible or a commentary or anything. I don't object to you looking at all things like that, but I prefer that first you do it yourself. And this is a number of chapters, so I'm not asking anything but a rather superficial subdivision of it. Just what are the main subjects, and what are the points of division? Mr. Goodon? Well, how far did what we had go in 59? Let's say from 59 20, just the last part of 59. Take from there and run on through 63. But you don't need to look at 63 more than just to note the general subject and where the important divisions occur again. That is, you would not divide any one of these books for this purpose into more than three divisions at the most. Yes, I'd like it in by Friday night. Now I believe we are ready to continue with our discussion, and so I will go on to section 10, Roman numeral 10. And on Roman numeral 10, I'm going to call the relation of the latter part of Isaiah. Can this be turned down a little? Well, I can move the paper. The relation of the latter part of Isaiah to its earlier part. That's Roman numeral 10. We are now going to start this last section, but here I am speaking at the moment about the part from chapter 40 on. So under that, capital A, the higher criticism of Isaiah. And you notice I put the term higher criticism in quotes. 40 years ago, there was widespread discussion, is the higher criticism right? And among Christians, the term higher criticism came to mean the attitude of those who would divide the Bible books up into all sorts of sections, and say they were written by different authors than they seem to be, and at different times. And the term higher criticism came to mean the same thing to most Christians as destructive criticism might. But in most classes 40 years ago, even if they were classes taught by thoroughly orthodox men, they would say the term higher criticism should not be thought of as having a bad connotation. Higher criticism simply is a term for investigation, they would say, of who is the author, when was it written, what is its unity. And they would say that term is used with all literature. And there's nothing wrong with higher criticism, it's just lower criticism is trying to get the exact text. studying the meaning of particular words, higher criticism is studying authorship, unity, questions like that. Well, that's what they would have told you 40 years ago in any class in Old Testament study. And today, I fear many Orthodox teachers in Orthodox schools will say the same thing. In fact, it wasn't long ago that I thought it to be true. And then I got out of the public library all the books I could get on literary criticism. Books which were not particularly concerned with the Bible, but with literature in general. And I looked up the term higher criticism in their indexes, and I found that practically all of them didn't give the term at all, never referred to it in their book. It is not a term used in literary study today, outside of the Bible. And I found in the few books of that type that did use the term, they used it only in relation to the Bible. The term has now been given up in literary study, the term higher criticism. Not only the term, but the thing that it stood for. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, literary critics would take almost any work of literature and divide it up into all kinds of sections written by different authors at different times. Today, that is just about entirely given up regarding all literature except the Bible. But the Bible students, many of them, are way behind the times in this regard. And in most any university that you would take a course in religion, and in almost any theological seminary that's over 40 years old, you will find that they are dividing up the Bible according to these theories. And so, we still use the term higher criticism because it's come to be a term for that sort of division. I met a man teacher in a seminary in this city long ago who told me that he was meeting with others from other seminaries and they were discussing the boundaries of Q, just exactly what parts of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are from the Q source and what parts are from other sources. They are tremendously interested in subdividing it. This half verse goes here, this verse goes here, and so on. They don't do that today with other literature. At least hardly anybody does. But it still is taught in all of the older schools as established fact. Well, now we're interested here simply in the higher criticism of Isaiah, and we're not going to take much time on that. Yes? Oh, thank you. How's that? I guess since I'm not using the part of the Bible like this, is that better? Take the other. Very good. It's hard to move because you move the wrong direction. There is no question that anyone, no evidence that anyone questioned Isaiah's authorship of any part of the book until the 18th century. There were people in ancient times who said Daniel didn't write the book of Daniel. There were beginnings of the denial of biblical books in ancient times. But we have no evidence before the 18th century that anybody questioned that the book of Isaiah was one continuous unit written by one man. And of course, the book says his name was Isaiah. But number two, the two Isaiah theories, about 200 years ago, one of the higher critics advanced a very simple theory. Its apparent simplicity. You look at Isaiah 1 to 39, you'll find many mentions of Isaiah. Oh, I shouldn't say many, not over 10, but there are quite a few. You look at Isaiah 40 to 66, the name Isaiah never occurs from 40 to 66. You look at Isaiah 1 to 39, you have occasional mentions of specific Israelite kings, particularly in the chapters from 36 to 39. You have no Israelite king mentioned by name after that, after chapter 40. In the section 1 to 39, you have many statements that the land is going to be taken into exile if the people do not repent from their sins. In the section from 40 on, you find it presupposed or assumed that exile is already here. In the first part, There are many references in the background to situations in Palestine. In the section from 40 on, you get the feeling he's talking to people way across the desert in Babylonia. So it's a very simple theory. Here's Isaiah's book, chapters 1 to 39. Somebody, they say the great unknown, a greater writer than Isaiah. They call him Deuteral Isaiah, second Isaiah. He wrote a book. He wrote it more or less in the spirit of Isaiah, but it was 150 years later. And some way, since it was so similar, it got written on the same scroll. And it didn't have any title, so people forgot that it was by a different writer. Well, you might say, what's the great difference? God inspired it all, whether there was the first book Isaiah wrote, the other by a great unknown 150 years later. You might say that at this point. It is a very apparently simple theory. But number B, hardly any scholar holds that view today. Hardly anyone holds that particular view today. That was advanced, and today among conservatives, sometimes you will find that theory argued for. People who are conservative on other points will argue for this about the two Isaiahs. But modernist scholars, hardly anybody, if I doubt if there's one that holds any two Isaiah theory today. So we look at three more recent higher critical attitudes. And we find that it was not long after this theory was advanced that people began to look at Isaiah 40 on and look back at 1 to 39 and find parts of it that they said were similar. And so they said, the same evidences that show us that much of 40 on wasn't written by Isaiah also shows many sections of 1 to 39 that weren't by Isaiah. So they broke 1 to 39 all up into little sections. And then, small B, I'll call Treto-Isaiah. It was noticed in the great argument and discussion that was carried on between those who said the book has a Palestinian background, is written by Isaiah in the time of Hezekiah, and those who said no, the last part from 40 to 66 has a background of Babylonia, when the exile is already in progress. It was noticed that those who said the background is Babylonia were presenting most of their evidence from chapters 40 to 55. And those who said the background is Palestine were presenting most of their evidence from the last 10 chapters. And so they said, no, there is a third Isaiah, Trito Isaiah. And so they said the last 10 chapters or so, they differ to just where the division should be made. They were written 100 years after the second Isaiah. So you have three Isaiahs. And if there are any who today, any critical scholars who hold to two Isaiahs, you'll probably find six for every one of them who will hold to three Isaiahs. But they don't merely hold to three different books written by three different authors. You pick up almost any critical commentary today and they will say, the question is this by Isaiah or not? The question is, examine these verses here and decide what is the time at which they probably were written. And so they'll say, here is 6.5 verses that were written probably 100 years before Isaiah. Here's 100 or so verses that were probably written 300 years after Isaiah. Then here's 6 verses maybe written by the second Isaiah. And then here's 10 verses written by an unknown author. And so the book came to be completely fragmented. Now that was the practice of critics, let's say 20 years ago, to completely fragment. There's a little tendency to see the absurdity of going to such extremes today, and there's not quite as much fragmentation as there was. But you will find books entitled The Second Isaiah, and you will find that most of the books, even by some written by fairly conservative authors, will adopt part of this theory. Now, number four, a glance of the arguments. Number one, the historical background. This is a very strong argument. The second, from 40 on, passage after passage talks as if exile were already in progress. This is a very strong argument. And as I see it, Isaiah talks in great parts of chapters 1 to 39 to the nation as a whole. And he told them, if you do not turn from your sin, God is going to send you into exile. You are having these terrible problems with Sennacherib and these Assyrian armies. Worse things are ahead for you if you do not turn from your sin. And he even at the end of chapter 39 specifically predicted they would be taken into exile, not into Assyria, but into Babylonia, which seemed to them at that time to be a rather insignificant force subject to Assyria. But from 40 on, 40, comfort ye my people, call unto Jerusalem that her iniquity is pardoned, that her warfare is ended, and so on. You have a tone which is very different. You have, I explain it by saying that in chapter 40, Isaiah turns his attention away from the ungodly mass of the nation to the very sizable group of believing people who were knowing that what he said was true, knowing that exile was certain to come, and he was giving them comfort. And they were already familiar with exile. The northern kingdom had already been taken into exile. And they knew what it meant. And they knew that the sin of their nation was just as Isaiah said it was. Exile was sure to come, and they would tend to give way to despair. And Isaiah said, no, God is not true with Israel. God has a great work yet for Israel to do. There's the work of the servant of the Lord that must be accomplished. And so, from 40 on, sometimes it's called the Book of Consolation or the Book of Comfort. He was speaking to the godly remnant and comforting them. And from 40 to 56, that is his principal emphasis. And so the argument from historical background, if you do not believe in a God who could enable his prophet to predict the future, is an absolutely unanswerable argument. And to those who do not believe in such a God, it is clear that Isaiah could not have written chapters 40 and following. There are two other main arguments advanced. They say there are differences in the style, and they say the theology is different. For instance, 1 to 39, God is majestic. In 40 to 66, God is universal. Well, they make all kinds of terms like that. And the terms do not contradict each other. They show a difference of emphasis. From 1 to 39, he's speaking to the nation of Israel with occasional glimpses of the outreach through the whole world of the message of salvation. But from 40 to 66, he is looking at the world and at the salvation God is going to bring through the servant of the Lord. And so the style naturally varies a little bit with the subject matter. You write on two different subjects, and your style is going to be somewhat different. And your emphasis in theology will naturally be different in two different situations. But there's no contradiction whatever between the theology of Isaiah 1 to 39 and Isaiah 40 to 66. And as far as the style is concerned, some of the critics say it is amazing that Deutero-Isaiah is so much like Isaiah in style, you'd think it was Isaiah risen from the dead. It was right. You can find differences in style with differences of subject matter, but the similarity of style is so great that I'm ready to say let almost anybody hear three chapters picked at random from Isaiah and then read them a chapter from almost anywhere in the Bible, and they'll be able to tell you whether it's from Isaiah or not, because Isaiah has a very distinctive style. He uses all through his book far larger vocabulary than any other part of the Old Testament. He has a poetic flavor and an approach that is found throughout the book and that is different from any other book. The only one that is fairly near it is Micah. And there are great differences between Micah, though not near as great as with any other part of the Old Testament. So there is one argument that really matters, and that is the argument from historical background. The other two can be looked at in detail and fairly easily answered. But unless you believe in a God who can predict the future, and not only predict the future, but enable his prophet to be so carried along that he actually imagines himself in the future, in that situation, and talks to people who know that exile is coming and who are tending to give way to despair and imagining themselves in that situation. Unless you believe in that kind of a God, you can't believe in the unity of Isaiah. Well, now, to me, the thing that matters is the New Testament attitude. And here we note especially, well, the New Testament quotes from Isaiah more than from any other book in the Old Testament, unless it be the book of Psalms, which has 150 chapters, as against only 66 in Isaiah. But the New Testament quotes many, many times from various passages of Isaiah, but about 13 times it quotes from it as the work of Isaiah. And six of these are from 1 to 39, the first 39 chapters, and seven of them are from the last 27 chapters, the cases where it says Isaiah says. And to me, one of the most interesting things is to look at the book of Romans and to see how God led the Apostle Paul to what language he led him to use in quoting from the book of Isaiah. We find there that in Romans 9:27, Paul says, Isaiah, the King James says Isaiah, following the Greek sounds instead of the Hebrew, but the two are identical, of course, in meaning. Isaiah also cries concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. This is quoted from Isaiah 10:22. And then we find that two verses further, he says, and as Isaiah said before, except the Lord of hosts had left us a seed, we should have been like Sodom and like Gomorrah. And this is a quotation from the first chapter of Isaiah, as you probably recall, Isaiah 1:9. So here are two quotations which he makes from the first part of Isaiah. Then in chapter 10, in verse 16, he says, for they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our report? Here he quotes from the second part of Isaiah. And he doesn't say, as we read in the book of Isaiah, Lord, who has believed our report? You could say the book of Isaiah, even if Isaiah only wrote the first chapter. Even if that's only the name of the book. But that's not what he said. Under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he said, as Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our report? So here he quotes from the second part of Isaiah, using the same terminology, exactly as he used quoting from the first part. And then four verses further on, in verse 20, he says, but Isaiah is very bold and says, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. And here he is quoting from chapter 65, verse 1, which is from the so-called third Isaiah. So here within two chapters, Paul quotes from the first Isaiah, the second Isaiah, and the third Isaiah, introducing them all with the words, Isaiah says, or Isaiah is very bold and says. It's very plain that he's not saying the book says, he's saying the man says. He could easily, Paul didn't have to enter into questions of criticism. He didn't have to tell us whether it was one Isaiah or two or three. He could have sidestepped the question. He could have simply said it's written in the book, or as the prophet said, or as it's in the book of the prophets or in the book of Isaiah. But the fact that he so specifically refers to all three parts as the work of Isaiah, to my mind, for a Christian, settles the matter that the book of Isaiah is one book written by one man, even though it is a difficult thing, humanly speaking, to believe that a man in the time of Hezekiah could look forward so specifically to events that would occur, a situation that would occur 150 years later. Now, capital B is that
Too high?
Yes. Okay, the important change at Isaiah 40. I've just been referring to that. Number one, the relation to the exile. We did not, for the purpose of this class, make references to specific passages, but there are good many of them that say that God is going to deliver you. He will take you home from Babylon. In the first part, in 39, he said they would go to Babylon as exiles. But there it was a prediction. Here he assumes them already there. Number two, the servant of the Lord. We took our last hour in seeing how that concept was developed. Israel cannot perish because Israel has responsibility for this great work that must be done. And so Israel is the servant of the Lord. But in the fullest sense, the servant of the Lord is one who is from Israel, who can represent Israel, but who is an individual and does a work not merely for the whole world, but for Israel also, as well as the nations outside. And so we looked at that last week, the development of this concept, the servant of the Lord. And number three, the possibility of prediction. It's to the when the Revised Standard Version of the New Testament came out, I found many excellent translations, and I found it in good flowing English. And on the whole, I was fairly well pleased with it. The Old Testament, RSV, did not come out until about 5 years later. And I said, the RSV New Testament strikes me as in many ways a wonderful translation. But when the Old Testament comes, we are going to have a very harmful book. Because, I said, it is possible for a group of men who do not believe in a miracle-working God, who do not believe in the necessity of salvation for Christ, who think of these as foolish, outworn ideas, nevertheless, to be first-class Greek scholars and to go to the Greek and see what those apostles believe and say, here is what these apostles believe. And so they present objectively, on the whole, a good translation of the New Testament. But when they combine it with a translation of the Old Testament, it is impossible for men with that viewpoint to think that men in the Old Testament times who could look forward 500 or 1,000 years and see Christ and predict it, and predict specific things about his birth and about his life, about his death and his resurrection. And therefore, these men, though they can objectively give a pretty decent translation of most of the New Testament, when it comes to the Old, they simply cannot believe that such things could happen. And therefore, they are bound to translate them in ridiculous ways. And when the Old Testament came out, I immediately looked up the Messianic passages in it, and I found that where it says, kiss the son that he was, lest he be angry, they translated, if I recall correctly, kiss his feet. And then they had a footnote, Hebrews obscure, but the very same word they translated in another place as the son. It's not the common word for son. But in the other place, they translated it son. And where Peter says that Jesus' resurrection fulfilled the statement in the psalm, thy holy one shall not see corruption. The RSV translated, he will not see the pit. And in the New Testament, they translated corruption. They have a footnote referring to the Old Testament passage, and in the Old Testament, they translated pit. And where it says that his goings forth are from of eternity, from everlasting, they say his genealogy is from way back. They get away from the messianic interpretations because naturally, not believing in a supernatural God, they can't believe that people back then could predict the wonderful things about Christ. They can't believe that. And so they have to twist it some way. But in just about every case, I found that the twisting they did was not in line with the actual study of the Hebrew, and that there was abundant evidence that the messianic translation was one which had plentiful evidence philologically. But that such a thing should occur, to my mind, the two clearest passages on it are 1 Peter 1:10 to 12, in which the apostle explicitly says, speaking about Christ, of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. So Peter says the Old Testament prophets did predict things they didn't fully understand. They predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. Now that doesn't mean we should do like some do and find Christ on every page of the Old Testament, twist everything in the Old Testament to fit with Christ, not at all. There's a great deal in the Old Testament about other subjects. But there are specific passages in almost every book of the Old Testament in which the prophet looks forward to the coming of the Savior. And how much he understood of it, I don't know. But there are these passages. And then Luke 24:25, when Jesus talked with the men, or with the disciples, on the road to Emmaus, when they thought that his life was ended, he said, "Fools and slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory?" And thus showed very clearly that they were to expect that God, through the Holy Spirit, enabled the Old Testament writers to see things they didn't fully understand and to predict things in the future. Well, now, if this can be true about the coming of Christ, there's no reason it can't be true about the exiled people. And there's no reason then that God could not enable Isaiah to put himself in the situation of those in exile, just as God was going to bring them back and speak to people who were themselves in imagination in that situation. Now, that was the change at chapter 40. And very interestingly, as I noticed once, I've never heard it said, but I happened to notice, just as there are 39 books in the Old Testament and 27 in the New, there are 39 chapters in what the critics call the first Isaiah and 27 in what they call the second. Now, that's one of the many coincidences in life, but it makes it easy to remember the fact, to notice it. But this is the most important changes at chapter 40. But now at chapter 56:9, there comes a change not as important as that, but let's say second in importance to that. And so I consider chapter 41 to 56:8 as one section, which I've written a book called Isaiah Sees the Savior, discussing that section and ending at that particular point, because it forms a very definite unit. And that is, I am very sorry that the Archbishop got so confused that he made his chapter division in such a way that one of the most important divisions in the book would be left right in the middle of a chapter. And so we have this important change at 56:9. Number one, there is a greater similarity to earlier portions hereafter than before. Now, there is also a difference between what follows in the early part of Isaiah. But in some ways, from 56 on, is more like the first 35 chapters of Isaiah than it is like chapters 40 to 56. 40 to 56 form a very definite unit. And this is somewhat like the earlier section. One most important reason is the alteration of sections in the many early parts of Isaiah of rebuke for sin, followed by blessing for those who are true to God. And that's very common in many of the prophetic books. And it's common in the early part of Isaiah. It's common from here on, but practically not found at all between 40 and 50. Then number two, the likelihood that the future emphasis continues at least to some extent. In other words, what do we find from 56:9 on? Does Isaiah, after looking forward to deliverance from exile, looking forward to the coming of the servant of the Lord, then come back to his own time and deal entirely with his own time? Or does he to some extent come back to his own time, but still look forward to the days after the exile? So to my mind, there may be a good bit of truth, not to the idea of a third Isaiah, but to the idea that in this part of the book, Isaiah does look forward to the some extent to the situation of the Israelites after they return from exile, but says many things that are equally applicable to the Israelites before they went into exile. And so I don't wish to be dogmatic on that, but I do think that it is very important to keep it in mind. There is at least one verse that is hard to imagine having been written before the exile in this last part, unless you believe that God led Isaiah to put himself in that future time and write in the first instance for people in his own day who put themselves into that time because they knew his predictions of things were bound to be fulfilled, but also in a way that would be even more helpful to people at the later date than they were in Isaiah's day, as was certainly true of Isaiah 40 to 56. Now we start then with looking at this last part. So in Roman 11, there is a succession of passages of rebuke and blessing, which comes after this breath. A succession of passages of rebuke and blessing, just as we had at many points in the first part of Isaiah. We have practically nothing like that, except to a very small extent, from 40 to 56. But now we have a succession. The next group of chapters are specifically a section of a succession of passages of rebuke and blessing. Now, I gave you an assignment early in this semester to look at chapters 56 and 57. And I believe that all of you noticed that between 56, 8, and 9, there was a very sharp break. But then, that from 56, 8 on for quite a distance, it is all rebuke to sin. And then there's a section that is all blessing to God's people. And so those sections begin with a chapter, with Section A, rebuke against the watchmen and the leaders of the people, 56:9 to 57:13. We have under number 11 here, we have a three times this alternation. We have the rebuke, the blessing, the rebuke, the blessing, and then the rebuke, and then a looking forward to the wonderful things God is going to do. We have a long section that is made up of this triple alternation. And so the first part of it is this rebuke against the watchmen and the leaders of the people, 56:9 to 57:13:8. And in my notes here, I have indicated a number of comments on individual verses there, which I think could be helpful and edifying, but are perhaps not as important to us as some of the things you will strike later on, and our talk is moving. What time do you think it is now about, actually? But 48 now? Well, then that's not too far off, we can go another 5 minutes, maybe. Maybe I will call your attention to a few of those matters, which are in this section. You notice it starts, verse 8 ends the previous section. The Lord God who gathers the outcasts of Israel says, yet will I gather others to him besides those that are gathered to him. That ended that section, the previous verse, my house shall be called a house of prayer. Now probably the archbishop was misled by the fact that after saying they're going to be gathered, the next verse says, all ye beasts of the field come to devour. And here there's a gathering and then there's a coming. But actually, there's such a complete break between the preceding and following verses that I think there should be a complete new start there. But then he goes on, why are the beasts of the field called to devour? Why is God calling for vengeance on the people? Because the watchmen are blind, they're ignorant, they're all dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleepy, lying down, loving to slumber. Somebody once said that the DD often means dumb dog. And, of course, that is true in areas where you have modernism coming in and where a man who really believes the Bible keeps quiet for fear of not getting the DD given by some college. And so in such a case, it should mean dumb dog. It should, of course, actually, it should mean The DD is an honorary degree, which colleges used to give to somebody who would have somebody in his congregation give a good sum to the college, or who they really thought deserved. And of course, many who received the honorary DD fully deserved it. And I was very glad to see many get it. But there were many other cases where they got it for wrong reasons. But his watchman, he says, they're not calling people's attention to the sin. I read a book just a couple of days ago by a great Christian leader who died a couple of years ago. And in this book, he speaks in most glowing terms of his years in a Christian college 50 years ago. He tells about his wonderful times there and how much this college meant to him and all that. He's a man who has written books showing the terrible modernism of our day. But he doesn't give even a suggestion in his book of the fact that that college, which was then a good Christian college, within 20 years after he graduated from it, became a place that tore down people's faith. I met a young fellow who went to it thoroughly believing in the Bible, wishing to make his life count for Christ. And when he graduated from that so-called Christian college, his mind was full of doubts, and he was very much upset and didn't know what he believed. And then he went to a seminary that was quite modernistic, and when he came out of that, he didn't believe in any Christian God. He was completely changed by that college. Well now, this man doesn't put a single word in about the danger of it. And people who love that man's wonderful preaching and some of his great stands for the Lord can read that book today and say, oh, that's where I want my children to go to college. And I'd far rather go to an atheistic college than to a college that has all the forms of pietism and all the terminology and yet is tearing down people's faith. I would say that to that extent, he is one described here. Blind, watching them blind, they're ignorant, they're dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. And so these watchmen are called slothful, lying down, loving to slumber. They're called selfish, greedy dogs, can never have enough. They're called sensuous. Verse 12, come, say they, or we'll fetch wine, we will fetch ourselves strong drink. Their selfishness again is stressed in the next two verses, and then verses 3 and 4 again. As stressed their sensuousness and their idolatry and so on. And we better not glance today at the blessing to the men of faith, 57:13b to 19. And I believe I've already given the assignment, and we better close so you won't be late to your next class. College, Brewster College in Ohio. And when I was in seminary, we had a lot of seminary. It was supposed to be a very wonderful Christian college. But it had been, I think, when he went. He wrote a book. He died 2 years ago, and he wrote the book 2 years before that. And in the book, there are sections where he lashes out at some reason modernistic development. But in the early part, you notice all the wonderful times he had at Worcester and how grateful he is to the college and never the slightest word.
Yes. Great. Question. I have a question here. Should I just leave it there?
Yeah, just give it to me. It's better to give it to me separately because I might get it.
When did the book come out?
Well, I hope it'll come out next day. But they can't promise. I think they feel quite confident of May, but they're trying to look at May. I told them I'd rather get it, and I told them I'd like to get it before seminary is over. I said if it come out after school's over, it might as well wait till fall. So they are trying, but they had a girl supposed to edit it, and she suddenly quit. And so now the head of the department is trying to do an experiment. So they said whether it can come out in April is moot.
I see.
But I got a very fine letter from the one who is editing it. Was very encouraged, so I'm hoping. I'm impatient myself. I just hope it reaches the people. But so much depends on the review. I know. If you get, if the magazine sends it to somebody who has a personal grudge against you, or if it looks like some little points you've made, he can write a review that will show you to buy. On the other hand, if it comes to somebody who really liked it, it can make a big difference.
I see.
So, you can't predict whether it's going to have a wide circulation or not. But I hope it will, because I believe the idea is going to work. And there are a lot of insights in it that the Lord has given me. I haven't come across another book. I'd like to have them get out.
Yeah. Is this on, what's the chapters in Isaiah?
40.
And you're going to put other books out on the rest of the chapters in Isaiah?
Well, if this one goes well, I hope you put some out on other books. This one is, I think, the most important part of Isaiah, and I did it first. And I'm just hoping it's going to be well. But that's not the next thing I'm going to do. After this, I'm going to do one of the prophecies of Daniel.
Oh, really?
And I've got that 9/10 for it now. I wrote most of it 2 years ago, but then I left it now to work on it.